Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks so much for being with us at this festive holiday time, and I'll be talking more about that in just a minute. But we have a wonderful guest tonight. Mike Eakin has an incredibly broad background in the healing arts, and I'm looking forward to hearing both his story and all the things that he does. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing, and I just want to make a quick announcement that because of the holidays, and the holidays fall on Thursday, both Christmas Day and New Year's Day are on Thursdays, we're not going to do live shows for the next 2 weeks, because I figure most people are going to be preoccupied. So we will rerun some of the wonderful interviews that have been done in the past, and we will be back in 2015 with more incredible folks to talk to. So tonight's metaphysical musing is about this time of year. And everybody knows that we have all these holidays. We have Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, all coming out at the same time. So why is that? And why is it that they all seem to have the same underlying theme of light and the return of the light, or overcoming darkness and miracle of light? Why is that? Well, it's because this is the time of the winter solstice. And the winter solstice is the moment in the year which is the longest night and the shortest daylight, the shortest day. And not only is it that, because, you know, the days are always getting longer and then they're getting shorter. That happens all year. It's not only that. What happens on the solstice is that the sun hangs in the same place, not making the days longer or shorter, for 3 days. And what that means, all over the Northern Hemisphere, every indigenous culture, every mythology has looked at that and realized that in this moment, if nature does not take its course and the days don't start getting longer, we're all going to die. It's going to stay dark and it's going to stay cold. So what they've done all over the world is create these stories, taken the stories that are in their mythology about miracles of light, which is the Hanukkah story. There was enough oil for the light to consecrate the temple for 1 day, and miraculously it lasted for 8 days. Or the story of Jesus, which is the return of the sun, S-O-N, which happens on the moment of the return of the sun, S-U-N. And all of the stories have this theme of light and the return of the light and miracles of light. And every one of the cultures has a ceremony that involves lighting flames, whether it's the Hanukkah candles or it's the Yule log or it's the bonfires in some of the northern cultures. And it's always a time for people to get together and celebrate and give each other gifts. Get together in the time of the coldest and darkest night and make each other feel warm, make each other feel happy, take care of each other. So all over the Northern Hemisphere, all the people have come up with variations on the same story, and all for the same reason. So while we may think that everything that's going on in the different cultures is different, in so many ways, as is often true, it is really about the same thing. The underlying message is the same, and that message is, at this moment in time, we're going to get together, light the lights, tell stories of overcoming darkness, and together we will overcome the darkness as we wait for the return of the light. And at this point in what's going on in the world, I think that's a really good message. There is a lot of really strange stuff going on. And I know a lot of people who are feeling very desolate about all the crazy things that are happening. But in the cycle of life and in the cycle of the mythology and the stories of every culture all over the world, the light always overcomes darkness. Every time. Doesn't matter how long it took. That's what happens. So here we are. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. I'm sure I am missing at least three or four other celebrations. I don't mean to leave anybody out. May we all be blessed, and what a wonderful time to be alive. So that's tonight's metaphysical musing, and now let's meet my new friend, Michael Eakin. Thanks so much for being on the show, Mike.
David, thank you. Wow, that was awesome. I liked listening. So.
Well, thank you.
Incredible.
It's something I talk about every year because it's a very striking story, but most people never put the pieces together. And I don't know how long ago I looked at all this stuff and went, hey, we're all doing the same thing here. It's all about the darkest night and over the return to the light.
I think we have a similar nature. We're both directed towards what's up and the science and unconditional love and how all those pieces fit together.
Absolutely. And part of the reason, and thank you for jumping in at the last minute, because somebody that was supposed to be here couldn't make it, and I was introduced to you, and I looked at your background, and there are a lot of similarities in the things that we do and the things that we've learned, but you've learned them from a different cultural context and in different places. So I'm really fascinated. I'm going to go down the list that I have of the various things that you do. Reiki and a whole bunch of other healing, energy healing modalities, martial arts, including Aikido, Tai Chi, and Qigong, massage, body work, meditation in the Taoist and Zen traditions, medical intuition, mediumship, remote viewing, a number of the expanded consciousness systems. And your apprenticeship list is really fascinating to me because it included osteopaths, native healers, Chinese healers, and doctors in Chinese hospitals and clinics. And that's really fascinating and exciting to me because I know Qigong is integrated into the Chinese medical system. But where I start with everybody on the show is, how did you wind up doing this? You know, what was the journey? What was the walk about? What led you here?
Well, great question. When I was little, I'd say I always had this ability to see things that I thought were the same as everybody else. But as years went by, I knew they were different. And so what I would see is people's thoughts, and they would be in the form of energetics. So I can't say it was the stereotype aura, but I would see the electromagnetic field, and I could tell if there was a lie going on or truth, or I could tell if there was a mystery going on, and I never paid too much attention to anybody's lies because I always felt that's what they had to do to move it along in their life. So as a little kid, somewhere around 11, I was with my mom, who I was seeing my great-great-great-aunt in an old bed, all, you know, looked like out of a Victorian house. And she was entering and leaving her body up and down, up and down. I didn't know that meant death, as I'd never experienced that. When the death happened, I felt the change in the body's chemistry. And at that point, at 11, it opened up a whole field of phenomena-generated stuff. Being 64 now, it was way before, you know, the subject developed, at least, you know, Google and all the internet and all the different opportunities we have now for consciousness. And so I came from a little town of Stockton, which was dominantly Methodist or Protestant or Baptist. And I had to be very quiet as I started to grow up into, say, seventh and eighth grade. So, should I just roll along?
I find these stories absolutely fascinating. And part of the reason that I always do this is so that people can hear both the differences and similarities in the stories, because the stories are so similar.
Excellent. Well, as I was getting into the teen stage, it was interesting that I had a series of proper etiquettes, you know, my father was a dentist, and so we were schooled in proper etiquette and opening the door and pulling out the chair. And so the girls were, you know, it was their privacy not to always be telling the truth. So my model tonight is not truth versus a lie, but it brought a mystery to me. Why wouldn't people just report their feelings? And so I was a feeling-based person. And so the amount of emotion and feeling that was going through me kind of lent itself into further knowingness about people's health conditions. So, you know, my mom and dad were, oh boy, they were exhausted sometimes because I'd throw a fit, you know, as a kid. They'd say, oh, we're going to go somewhere. We're going to go to the mountains. And then I'd see that car, it would have a flat tire. So I said, so do we have a good spare? I had to be appropriate about this after a long time of mystery. And my dad would say, well, we have this really crummy spare. If it happened to pop, we'd have to come back. And then I would go, oh, why go? It's going to pop, you know, when we get to this place. So a lot of times they started thinking I was causing that. For many years, I had three questions. Do I see something? Do I make it up? Or do I head towards it? All three of those are in different books in any bookstore, right? As single items.
Right. And let's come back to that, because that's one of the classic questions in metaphysics.
I know. So I basically, you know, we went, the tire popped, we went home, and that was that. So as I got into high school, I started seeing and feeling unusual things. A gal one time, she was just too far away across campus. I went to call her name. It was Linda. And it didn't. I thought, oh, that's too far to yell. And she took a couple steps, turned around, waited for me. She says, I was in deep thought. I didn't hear you very well. I'm like, oh, okay, make a note of that. That's what I said to myself. So as the science guy, I started making notes of things, you know, like, and I always thought that things were outside of myself, that God wasn't, in fact, me. And there was a lot of time spent, and you could see that in my profile of what you God was, it was like outside adventure, checking out different things in life and different viewpoints and different religions, and so I could see what's it all about. And as it went along, I started developing much more advanced thinking and feeling on where I've gotten to now. So
when did you start going to various places and learning all these things that you learned? If it's like everybody else's story, one thing led to another thing, one introduction led to another introduction.
Wow, that's great. As a sophomore in high school, I think that was 65, I had a lot of out-of-the-body experiences, but I didn't have much to go on for reading. I would go to the library and pull out books, and most of them are from Asia, and I've got to tell you, as I started going to Asia in 83 and lived there for a while, it really is real for what they, a lot of times they're in books and things like that. I can share some stories in a bit, but I basically started noticing that the out-of-body had variable colors, gray or clear or other colors, and I learned later those were different worlds, you know, and they were dubbed as you were sharing in different groups and different religions, they have similar color codes. And I found that really fascinating, as I could tell where I was by when I was out of the body, what kind of a color code was. If it was a certain color, I was in a certain place. And so I made kind of a science out of it. I just had myself as a curiosity. By the time I got into sophomore in high school, most girls were interested in going to the football game or doing those other things, and I got to be a junior and I was more interested in out of the body, so I'd say, hey, we could travel to the stars. I'd talk about it. Well, usually those were one time dates, so it really didn't.
Yeah.
I started wondering, you know, But so as I got to be a junior or senior, some different really advanced things happened to me. And so one or two of the types of things that would happen to me is psychokinetic stuff, where things would move, voices would appear out of the zone, you know, of and answers would come. And so I was having this go along and still not getting any kind of book reading that I could really do it without going into, say, cult. So I don't want to name anything I did directly that had a cult to it, but Stockton's close to Berkeley, so there's this wide range of spiritual people at the time. You know, one of them, which I really respected at the time, was Bob Ram Dass.
Yes.
So Ram Dass, in his early phases, was just a delight to hear from, because he said, never lose yourself. You know, I'm not quoting him, but he was saying, keep yourself in the equation. Where some other groups were saying, follow me, do it my way, or kind of move to the highway. So as I tried to sort things out, different things would happen. Like my friend was supposed to pick me up, and it was way back when there was no cell phones. And I thought, well, at that time, one of those types of psychologies, which is supposed to be like, let your voice out and, you know, scream or something like that. So I said to this gal, I don't remember her name now, maybe say Barbara. I said, Barbara, where in it are you? Because we're late for, you know. And all of a sudden the phone rings and she's real timid. She goes, are you okay? And I'm like, now I've got food on my face, right? I mean, yeah. She goes, well, I was combing my hair. She had hair like down to her knees. I said, I was combing my hair and I heard, and she duplicated exactly what I said, which then I put on the shelf. Okay, maybe not say things always. So that was probably one of many times that came back on me. Fortunately, I learned from those things. But as I went a little further, I got into a program at that time. I can't promote it or not now, but I can tell you that it was called The Science of Soul Travel. And Paul Twitchell was alive, and he was out of San Diego doing a writing, and it wasn't a religion yet. He'd actually, I think, incorporated it, if I can quote this, in Nevada. So it was more of a science. And I wish I had those discourses now, because they were wonderful. But the idea was going out of the body and traveling to different locations for the model that he was using and promoting, and it worked. You know, I could get out and get some stability in it. Still thinking on the outside that it was outside of me. You know, things were happening to me instead of me being the precursor to the experience. And so I was probably 67, 68 in Las Vegas. Paul Twitchell was going to a convention. You know, he was going to be the head of the convention. And so I got in my old Volkswagen bus with my friend, and we went zooming down there, and he'd fallen asleep in the back, and I fell asleep, and I went off the freeway. So this blue light, which represented him, appeared in my forehead, and he yelled my name, and then I was outside of the van, and I saw the wheels, and I turned it back onto the freeway. That was the best thing I'd ever experienced. Chris and Bob stayed awake the whole trip after that. I had to wake him up to tell him the experience, right? So here's the really cool part, David. This is what made me go, ooh, like timid, or am I for this or against this? Because when I got down there and I'm at the convention, he walks by me with a couple people and he looks at me with this really incredible, unconditional love look. And he tells me enough pieces of the wording without repeating it that he was glad I was safe from that incident. Real specific, and I kind of went, wow.
So he was obviously conscious of what
very
had happened and did it intentionally.
Very conscious. And that was so far back in time for me, and I just became enamored with the different ways that we can go to conscious. And remember the word I'm using, we can go to conscious instead of being asleep.
I know
some people have written books that almost say, wake up. So there's something there that I found fascinating with where I was going. So when I started to get into college, I was fortunate that there was a university here in Stockton that promoted India. So some of the people from India, and then I had a teacher also at the time when yoga was not well known. Now it's quite the story. But so Yogi Bhajan in Berkeley, I started working with for Kundalini and Tantra yoga at that time. And then I was working with John and another gentleman at the university and taking workshops and classes and hanging out. Because I was in my just early 20s, and so I was really going, this is the way to go. I'm going to head towards the Kundalini for enlightenment and put my ducks in a row. So at that time, as I got into that, I had a lot of good pieces of enlightenment, but I wound up taking over for the yoga teacher. She moved to Australia, and as I started working with other people, there's where the real enlightenment, and I think you know this really well, the real enlightenment is working with other people, being of service and helping them. Then there's this personal development that it can't be matched. You know, it can't be created using effort and force to get results on myself. It has to be genuine. So that's where I started moving, you know, into my 20s. I started moving into the developmental part of the yoga. And then somewhere in there, I got into the different, trying out different religions and stuff for the purpose of who's doing the right way. And I've got a great answer on that for if we get to that later. But somewhere in there, I moved on over to the Qigong. And the Qigong in the early 70s at the time was just some small groups. And I found it in a book and some small groups out of Berkeley and San Francisco were personal practice. And I always had a friendship towards the Asian people, so it was easy for me to move into their clandestine, quiet group of inner circle. And eventually, I loved massage because my healing phase kept traveling towards laying on the hands and massaging. And jumped backwards, forward. There was a group of people in Lodi, which is a little town next to me. And they were Seventh-day Adventists, and they were really strict about old-time healing skills. That's the osteopaths and physical therapists that would do different kinds of laying on of the hands and manipulating right. in different ways. And those just created these great changes that so helped me to develop my larger part of my personality that I finally said, I'm going to go to China, and that was by 83. I said, I'm going to go to China and study the massage over there. So I took a
fantastic. We need to go to a break in about a minute, so I want to make sure that people know how to find you online. What's your website?
My personal website is www.michaeleakin.com.
And why don't you spell that?
You bet. MichaeleAkin.com.
Fantastic. So
now I'm still building it out right now. It's got lots of content and different pictures, but the healing part and the Qigong part are still being built out. The mediumship and psychic consulting part is on there to be displayed.
Right.
So it's good to go for a starter.
I know how that is. It's always a work in progress.
Cool.
So we are going to be back shortly, unless, of course, we get taller, with my guest, Michael Eakin, who does all kinds of different healing work, and I'm really looking forward to hearing about China. Here on the Farkas Files, this is David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio. Don't go nowhere.
styling your hair every day, and do you want a good hairstyle every day? Hi, I'm Sarah Schuster. I went on a website called InventNow.org, and after that, I decided to invent something too. Something called the InstaDo. Just imagine, you just put it over your head like a helmet does, and you pick your hairstyle with the buttons on the side. Then you can have instant hairstyle in seconds. People like it. People like Jeff Bart.
I like it.
And people like Kenneth.
It's this helmet thing, and it fits over your head, and it's great.
Thank you, Kenneth. You should go to inventnow.org, and it could help you come up with your own invention. After all, look at me on the radio now.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at inventnow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Have you ever dreamed of being a karate master? Well, stop dreaming and start chopping with the Karate Glove.
Hi, my name's Molly, inventor of the Karate Glove, and I have just 1.5 words for you. Hi-yah!
The Karate Glove chops through anything. Just put it on and instantly chop through wood.
Hi-hi!
Concrete.
Hi-yah!
Brick walls.
Hi-yah!
Trees.
Hi-yah!
Small cars. It can even chop through these 8 guitars. It chops things.
If I can invent a karate glove, just imagine what you can do. Visit inventnow.org to get started on your invention. Anything's possible. Keep thinking.
Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
It's hi-ya time!
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude, what happened to your face? I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Ow.
Dude, what is
Ow.
This? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
That's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
Now, back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with my guest, Michael Eakin, who was just going to tell us about his adventures in China. In what year? 1980?
83 is the first time I went over there, and I was very excited. I had gone to a somewhere and see the little poster on the wall, and it said, "You too can go to China." Mm-hmm. Had a concept of massage, so I thought, "Well, gee, I'm doing massage." In the 70s, I had taught massage at a school in Sacramento, the Sacramento Holistic Health Institute of California. It was a whole eclectic group of people, yoga and all sorts of different cool people that I was finding and taking their skills and learning them. And so in 83, I thought, gee, I'm going to go over there and do that. So I had a very good time. Lots of responses the first time. I mean, I got to see, because 73-74 is when communism collapsed. It didn't work. They had a big starvation thing going on, sharing everything and doing it the way they were doing. It just didn't work. I know our government, their government, I'm not very political. They throw rocks at each other, and maybe a lot of people would think that China's still communist. It's just not. You know, so if there's any communism, it's like a Boy Scout group. So the point is by 83, they were coming out of this extremely poor time. But the healing part, the laying on of the hands, the acupuncture, the different skills they had there was phenomenal. And the Qigong part. Maybe I should share Qigong Qi is a lucid word for energy, and it could be applied to anything. It would be like the word dance, but then you'd have specific dances, right? You'd have ballet, you'd have Western, modern dance. So Qi is a real lucid term, and then Gong is work or practice. So Qigong had been part of their practice for probably several thousand years. And the idea of it was developing immune system and health overall. And then the Taoist, which I got into, although I'm not a Taoist specifically, but I studied it to find out what's up with them. As I went into that, the Taoists were using these different methods of breathing to go to a state of enlightenment. Now, enlightenment doesn't mean going somewhere like a different heaven. Enlightenment is just being where you are with unconditional love, and don't sweat the small stuff with the small brain, meaning the physical mind. And so those kinds of pieces I was going through and finding my own way on. And so in 83, it was my first, say, 6 weeks there. It was in the lower part of China. Now I like to go to the middle and upper part of China just for my own purpose. But the lower part was around Canton and Fosun and Taishan and down below that was Hong Kong, and it was a fascinating experience when I went to the temples, and I saw lots of mysteries, you know, different things I didn't understand. I say that everybody, this is just my personal bias, is everybody should go to somewhere in their life and live there, wherever that is, and learn the language anywhere for a couple of years and come back. There's a whole different viewpoint on the world by stepping outside of one's world, getting a life experience and going back into their own world. I'm really blessed to have been able to experience that, so I can see how different things work in the world. But I moved from 83 into then just different trips along the way. Probably in 2000, Qigong had come out of the closet, so to say, and really started developing itself into the public domain. And one of the types of Qigong was a gal was still alive. She was about 108, and she did wild goose Qigong. And so by 2000, over to 2002, I had learned the whole form by a master that I was working with at the time. And he was in the back country. Now the fun starts, because these guys do these incredible things. But the Chinese, I'm always speaking of China, the Chinese are very clandestine. They're very quiet about things. They need to produce something, and if they say they can do it, they can do it. Maybe it's seen as a false sense of pride if somebody shares something, but they're so dominantly accurate, and if they can't do it, they say nothing. And
right.
They won't participate. But I, as an example, one master I had, he was around 90, and it was great. You would have loved to have been there. Here I am sitting in this room. Next to me is the master. Okay, and we're going to do what's called Jing, J-I-N-G, Jing meditation. That's a spiritual meditation. And so he is from the back country. They pulled him out. He'd been doing like 50 years of it. And I said, 50 years? How did you focus for 50 years? He says, I was the wrong communist. 50 years in prison. In prison! So I guess there was more than one communism, right? So I'm like, ooh, that'll give you a lot of time to meditate. So then he had his wife there, she was probably around 55. And then there was my master who was teaching me a different Qigong, and then my interpreter friend, I'll call her Dana, English name. And every time he would say something, it would go around the circle, and she would turn it into English. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, this is cool. And somewhere in there, of course, I got bored, and I drifted off. David and I was seeing the scenery, and I was somewhere else, and I wasn't doing the drill. So now, this gentleman still got his eyes closed. So he says something that goes all the way around the circle, and she goes and tells me exactly what I'm looking at, where I am, what I'm not doing, and I need to come back and participate. Well, I thought, holy moly. And after that, I kept one eye open watching him for a while, like, how is he doing that? And then finally, I got with the program and realized that enlightenment is always there. It's just there. We don't wake up to enlightenment. Enlightenment's occurring. We somehow or other, as is it, just let it, the isness of it, just occur. You know, don't sweat the small stuff. Stop, you know, going up river, all those different saints. And so, right. But at that time, I wasn't fully, I was still oblivious to things. And so as I got along on that, I learned to admire the different teachings of these people. Somewhere else, I went to a Buddhist temple. I love to go to the temples and check things out, and they had this huge slate. It had kind of a visual of a yin and yang symbol. It was just this big slate. It was probably a yard by a yard and a half. And I said, what is that? What does that represent? And they said, well, you can look into that, and you can see elsewhere. Now, This is the truth, literally. I looked into it very gently. I thought of somebody, and I saw what they were doing, and I verified it when we got off the trip. It was a different trip, you know, physically as far as time. I went so many times, right? I'm just telling a future story from the last one. So I got home, and the man had seen me. And so we verified stories with each other, and it was very exciting. But I have a more pronounced story. We went out in the back of this temple, and there was this huge mound, and there was a statue of a form of a Buddha. And we were standing there, and here's my Qigong master and Dana, and here's two monks, and they're standing there. And I thought, well, this is kind of boring. And also, very respectfully, this is really cool. Here I am in the back of China, out in nowhere. I mean, bugs are big enough that could probably throw me to the ground, you know, stuff like that. a snake went across the road, and I screeched. It was the size of King Kong, you know. It's pure black, and everybody was hollering. And one man turned around with, you know, hard English. He says, good to eat. I said, no, I'm going to let it move on down the road. So here I am, and all of a sudden, this something grabs my finger. It was, I still remember, it was the most soft, intimate, fuzzy, velvety feeling. I had never felt some spiritual feeling so much. And I looked at my finger, and it was a bumblebee the size of a golf ball, almost. And I screamed, and I threw my hand in the air, and the bumblebee flew off, and it bounced off the stone Buddha's head and landed in front of the two monks, you know, the two monks in Buddhism, and then it died. And I said, and it can't be good. But luckily, if something did happen to me later, it was minor. I hope that's the end of that story. I will knock on wood. But moving over to the healing part, I got to work in the hospitals. I still do. People's Hospital, Navy People's Hospital. I worked with a Master Chun, and he teaches me a practice called Tui Na. Tui Na is a real lucid form of the word is push, grasp. I like to use the word push, pull. It's a way of using the body. But they've developed this whole system. We know it as acupuncture, moving around the channels. There are currents around the body. And they are highly skilled psychically using their hands. Mm-hmm. Lao Gong is like, if you've ever seen the Buddha eye, it's in a hand sometimes on Buddha. It's an all-seeing eye. Well, I trained up in that so I could place my hand on the person, away in space from the person, or even on an object at a distance from the person. And I could go over. Like right now, I could say, oh, your right elbow hurts on the lateral side of the epicondyle, and you have a small finger numbness from the ulnar nerve bothering you. I can transport it over to the physical universe with physical therapy. And then some people would say, wow, you found that. And somebody else would say, but maybe you made it happen to me. So I thought, no, really?
Well, we can get back to that because we could kick that idea around a lot.
Oh, I got lots
but
of stuff.
But I want to just clarify a couple of things about Qigong for my own fascination. There's Qigong, which is a martial arts-like form. And there's Qigong, which is a form of energy medicine like other forms of laying on hands. Perfect. And I know that they're related. I know that in the Chinese medical world Qigong masters work in the hospitals as another form of treatment. But I don't really, you know, other than knowing that it's both, and obviously it's one system, I don't know a whole lot about it. And I just recently started learning a form of Tai Chi that's specific for people that have joint issues by a gentleman named Paul Lam, who's a physician, Chinese physician, but he lives in Australia. And developed this system for people with arthritis and other issues. So it's my first time really doing a Chinese martial arts form, even though it's a very modified version of it. And I'm just fascinated with all of it.
Well, the history of the forms were generated by the people for whatever purpose they needed. It could even be a better dancer. But then there would be thousands of forms to there's millions of people practicing. And then also the medical Qigong could be self-Qigong with focused thinking and focused breathing. And then it could also be sending energy out to somebody else. They have a saying in Chinese medicine that if you don't feel good, you get help from the person that can help you, you know, like the acupuncture and or the medical Qigong person who can do the energy work on you. Then when you feel better, you learn the exercises to help yourself.
Right.
Qigong, they have self exercises to help yourself. And then if you're inclined to, the third one would be to learn things to help others, pass it on. So the premise is based on the 12 energy channels that run around the body and the three main centers, the lower center of the gut, and the one around the heart, the pericardium, and then the one in the hypothalamus area in the brain is the third center, and they were named Dan Pian. Dan is a container. Have you have like clay pot pork or something like that in Chinese food? That pot is a Dan, D-A-N. Old term for it was T-A-N. But anyway, so T-N just means level. So lower level, gut, middle, upper. So the lower levels where we store energy. And the middle area in the chest around the heart is where the soul's connected, if I can use that word that way. And it is what motivates us, you know, our passion and everything like that. So the energy in the heart refines this qi. And then what moves us to heaven, which is the Jing meditations or whatever other kind of meditations we're doing, is in the head. So they connect the three. And the same is really lucid in the earth, which is the gut, goes the stem, which moves up to the flower, up to the petals, which is the heart, and then it flowers in the head. So the lotus comes from the mud, and its purity goes up and out the head. So it's a very lucid. The people are very visual, very lucid, artistic people in Asia.
So. Yeah, beautiful imagery. I know when I first saw pictures of Qigong masters working in hospitals, and I watched, you know, basically to most people, it just looked like they were focusing and waving their arms. And I looked at it and went, oh, I can see what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Looks very similar to this or that I've done and that I've seen other people do. So I'm sure in many ways, it's just another version of all the other things that tap into how to work with the energy. But I just, since I very recently started tapping into the martial arts forms and their relation to healing, I'm just fascinated. It sounds like you've done a whole lot of work with it.
Yeah, my whole life, I took the Qigong part and I stuffed it into my sanity clause for coming forward because I utilize the Qigong breathing and things like that to drop down into mediumship to talk to the dead who are really quite alive, just without a body. So I'll give you two short stories. One time when I was in China, I had taken a group of people over there. I owned a massage school for many years called Body Tune Up. I closed it in 2012. But I took people over from the school to learn the different practices and get some education. And so I had this small group of people, and I'd taken other groups over there, and Master Chun. It's kind of funny. You go into a hospital and everybody is Master Chin, Master Chun, Master Chun, Master Chin, Master Chin, and Master Li, which is actually kind of funny because I go, well, how do these guys know when they're calling each other over the talk phone who's who? Because I would go to the hospitals, but you know, they'd speak in Chinese. I learned some, but not a lot. So anyway, if I got lost in China, which I have in history, I don't know enough to get around by myself. But I went ahead and I realized that this man would send energy at a distance from behind, and he can move people around and send it through the body, and all the other people would witness it. So later, and another time after several times of taking people, he didn't do that. He stood in a circle and he moved around, and I was getting disappointed on the fact that he wasn't doing what I wanted the people to see, because I had told them, right? So I took a photo of what they were doing, and at the time, it wasn't a cell phone. It was a regular camera, and I didn't develop it yet. But at the time, he said, oh, we did it. We did it all together in a circle. And when I got back home, I had it developed, and it was blinding white light all around the room, around the group. It was this incredible, definite light. It wasn't a flash phenomena. That's one story. Now here's my better one, and I've got probably 100 of them. But I took one man over to China. He was a rather big man, maybe 300 pounds, and he had a tumor the size of a softball. And so I just wanted his back to get relaxed. So I took him to Master Tong. And now Master Tong, just to prep the story, I didn't like too much because Tong means pain in one of the Chinese words. And he had hands the size of baseball bats, and he made sure he applied his Tui Na different than I like to. You know, I only trained with him once or twice with the group, and then we moved away. But he went to private clinic with the big guy. We got in a small room, and I was having fun, and at angles, a small table, we could barely fit in there. Was telling the two Chinese gals they were just thumping on his feet to have something to do before Master Tong came in. I was having fun going harder, harder. And he was hollering, and that was good for me just for fun. And all of a sudden, Master Tong comes in the room and this tremendous light. It was like a soft blue moved through the room in my vision. And they quickly left and he stood there. And it looked just like out of a movie. He did a horse dance, like a Wuji stance, and he got down low, put his hands out from each other, like you might see in the beginning of Tai Chi. And he waved his hands, and I'm going, holy, you know, whatever. This, I've never seen him do this. And so my friend looked at me out of the side of his eye. Now I'm going to report this real literally. And he panicked because my face was thrown, you know, like if he could do that, what's he going to do here to this man's baseball? And he says real quickly, what's he going to do? I said, I don't know. He's going to heal you or kill you. I don't know which one. And he panicked. You know, I said it really quick, and I snapped my neck. But the next thing that happened is he put his hands down so soft like a butterfly, and the tumor melted to zero. It just went, whoa, and it melted to zero. Big guy, big tumor. And there was a tremendous lurch of the man, and his whole body, which is a whole lot of body, did this profuse sweat instantaneously, and the black grit, sandy grit, came out of all his skin immediately, and it never came back. The tumor, I saw him for 3-4 years after that. It never came back, and so that's just another story from China, from doing the
Qigong
healing.
And I've heard stories like that from all over the world. So,
cool.
I know how powerful all of these techniques can be, especially when they're people who have spent decades, especially if they've isolated themselves and been with other masters.
That's it.
And really are able to get that depth of connection.
It's a focus. Without using effort and without using the left right brain. The reason for breathing is to drop self down into lower dantian, and it'll change. We know those change states as alpha or theta brainwave patterns. As a science, we've monitored the special effects of the phenomena by saying it's a brainwave pattern, but it's really not the pattern. The pattern just shows when the person's in the altered state.
Right. Well, I want to make sure people know where to find you. Please give your website again.
Oh, sure. It's www.michaelekin.com, and it's MichaelEakin.
And how are you still in Stockton? Where are you now?
I am. I do travel. I work in groups with people, and I do single healing situations. I develop my own techniques, and that's the way the ball rolls, so to say. I do mediumship in private and group, but I also work at the Golden Gate Spiritualist Church in San Francisco for, I don't know exactly, about 15, 16 years, but it under Reverend Del Lauterbach. He's like my mentor and great inspiration and guidance, and giving me a lot of focus. But he's from the church is from Reverend Florence Becker, who was a very famous and dedicated spiritualist. And I study the science of being. It's a book from her. But GoldenGateSpiritualistChurch.org is out there if anybody wants to see what's happening there. So,
well, it's so good to meet you, and I feel like, you know, we're old friends and we could talk for a very long time about all kinds of things. I hope I get to meet you at some point.
Cool.
So there's so much to share. Michael Ekin, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome.
And perhaps you can be on again and we can talk about some aspect of your work in more depth.
You're welcome.
And don't go anywhere, because I want to talk to you after we go off the air.
Okay.
So my guest tonight was Michael Ekin, who does a wide range of healing modalities, many of them based on what he learned in China. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, David.
And if folks got curious about who this guy David is, you can go to househealing.com, and cleverly hiding in plain view on the contact tab is pretty much every conceivable technology for getting in touch with me, including a scheduling calendar. I do a 20-minute free assessment of whatever's going on with a person, a place, a situation, and we can talk about how my work might be helpful with what's going on. A lot of the work I do has to do with properties that won't sell, or houses that don't feel right, or where strange things are going on. But I also work on people, situations, court cases, all kinds of stuff. If you want more information about the show, you can find that at thefarkasfiles.com. And the entire archive of however many years it's been, 3 or 4 years now, there's lots of interviews there. We're also on iTunes podcasts, iHeartRadio, and a number of the other streaming radio networks. You can just search for Farkas Files, or you can search for Empower Radio, and you will find all the information. My show is on Empower Radio at 9 p.m. Every evening. They do a rerun, and on Thursday, typically, we're doing the live recording of a show. But remember that for the next 2 weeks over the holidays, we will not have a live show, and we will be back in 2015 ready to do all kinds of other fun things. And that's what I want to leave you with. We have this wonderful holiday time in this dark moment that we bring light into. Enjoy your relatives, enjoy your friends, enjoy this time that feels a little bit different as we approach the new year. And, you know, everybody talks about New Year's resolutions and laughs that they never actually work out. We could have a whole show on manifesting things and why that's true. But if you really want something, if you're not just asking for nonsense, you know, I want more money, I want you. If you're really asking for what you want, really amazing things can happen in your life. So I encourage you to focus on what it is you really want to bring into your life in the new year.
And with that, let me wish you wonderful holidays, whichever ones you celebrate or don't celebrate. Happy, happy new year. And we will see you in a couple of weeks. This is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Have a fantastic holiday.